good to have you. Please take a seat. Scott, you just came over from the big conference stage, and I think I heard you kicked ass over there. And this is actually a little bit more mature audience. So on this stage, we can handle like a little bit more crass, more harsher topics. What might be predictions that you can't show on the big stage, but that would be interesting to explore in this area?
Okay. Oh, it's a question. I think that, my kind of biggest prediction, just based on what's happened the last 3 months, is I think that the U.S. over the last 80 years has massively benefited from this Amazon-like river flow of human and financial capital into the United States. So what are the best and brightest, generally speaking, have in common in the world? They want to come to the U.S. And our PhD students or entrepreneurs, we've just been a magnet for the best human capital. And in addition, there's been a massive inflow of financial capital. There's $5 million in venture capital for every startup in the U.S. There's $1 million in venture capital for every startup in Europe. The biggest thing to happen in 2025 is that twice in the last 10,000 years, the Amazon has reversed flow because of meteorological anomalies. We're about to see, for the first time in 80 years, a reversal of flow of human and financial capital outside of the U.S. because of what is taking place. So I think that the EU and China are going to be huge beneficiaries. Think of it as the biggest yard sale in the world, where $27 trillion economy is somewhat for sale right now on the cheap. There are European nations doing trade deals with Latin America and China, and basically the whole world is reconstructing its supply chain and alliances around America. I think that's the biggest thing that's going to happen or is happening in 2025.
Sometimes we have amazing people like yourself here on stage, and I'm sitting in the audience and I'm trying to ignore the advice when it's too uncomfortable for me to actually implement. Like, if you consider this like a roast me moment for Germany and Europe, what would be a roast that you could give where you say, these are things that Germans and Europeans need to hear, but they try to ignore?
Well, look, the EU needs to get its shit together. You're being intimidated by a murderous autocrat who is invading Europe, who has an economy that is one-tenth the size of yours. You have a $19 trillion GDP. Russia has a $2 trillion GDP. You should be able to push back. You should be able to win this war. And you've become fat and happy depending upon your rich uncle for military support. And you finally realize that your rich uncle has gone batshit crazy and can no longer be depended upon. So you need to figure out a way to cooperate and coordinate across all of the member nations, increase your defense spending, and push back on a murderous autocrat, as nobody knows better than Europe what happens when you let a murderous autocrat invade unchecked. So if you can't push back on Putin, it is entirely your fault.
That's quite clear. Let's hear it. You just mentioned geopolitics, but you guys have a new president. We had a quite surprising election, AI, a lot of things happen. Is there like a jaw-drop moment that you personally had in the last couple of weeks that you haven't talked about yet?
So the post-World War II order, if you look at what Germany's accomplished, what Japan has accomplished, what America has accomplished since 1945, we've created more prosperity in Europe and in the U.S. in the last 80 years than the entire, in terms of economic growth, than the entire world has created in its entire history. This has been unbelievable prosperity. And the biggest own goal in history used to be America's entry into Southeast Asia, into Vietnam. Then it was our entry into Iraq. These were stupid things, but they were mostly out of naivete and stupidity. The biggest own goal in history of a modern economy is happening now, where the U.S. has decided to declare war on its allies and give comfort to its enemies. The most hopeful thing that's happened in the last week is that our president has inspired such a gag reflex. The world is so disappointed and so, quite frankly, disgusted at the behavior of the American administration that it is swaying elections globally. In the last 10 days, two of the G20, Canada and Australia, have elected leaders because of Donald Trump. But the leaders they've elected are distinctly anti-Trump. In Canada, the Conservative Party parliamentary election coming into 2025, they had a 25-point lead on the Progressive Party. That's insurmountable. But because the Conservative Party was linked to Trump in Canada, the Progressive Party, the Liberal Party, overcame a 25-point deficit. So in sum, the whole world is so disappointed in America that they are electing leaders who are seen as being able to push back in a forceful yet dignified way. I think that is a very hopeful sign that the world is looking at America and thinking, we just can't go that way. We need to push back.
Currently, the U.S. has $36 trillion debt.
Yeah.
I think this year, close to $2 trillion are being added.
Yeah.
Is this a business model that can still scale? Or might some of Trump's actions be the sheer fear of the U.S. running into some sort of bankruptcy?
So if the U.S. was a household, it's making $50,000 a year, it's spending $70,000, and it has $370,000 in debt. But even if the parents can't declare bankruptcy, the kids in that household are going to have to pay back the debt. America and the American public have become drunk on deficits. And the UK and Japan have similar size deficits, which interesting is Germany actually has a relatively small deficit. I think it's 40% of GDP. The most kind of seminal economic action globally right now, it's the boring shit that makes the difference. The most boring thing that has happened that will have the biggest impact is the German government's decision to raise the debt limit and potentially the EU's decision to go from 1.9% of GDP spent on defense to 3%. That's an incremental spend of $200 billion in defense spending each year that wasn't happening before. That, in my opinion, will be incredibly stimulative for the economy. And while it's very easy to make an argument for why there's better things to spend money on than defense, if you look at the most valuable companies in the world, whether it's Apple, whether it's Meta, whether it's Microsoft, they're built on technologies that were developed during wartime. So the internet itself was built on the backbone of DARPA, which was initially financed as a post-nuclear attack communications network with no node or hub. Apple and Alphabet are built on GPS technology, which was a technology developed by the Defense Department to ensure that our missiles could literally strike a 10-meter wide target. So I think the decision for the EU, as led by mostly Germany, to make a pretty huge incremental investment in defense spending will be stimulative to the economy and likely in 3, 5, 10 years have dramatic spillover to the private sector as you develop your own technologies. I think that that's the most interesting or the most important event economically of the last 10 years. And I'm not just saying this because I'm in front of a German audience. I have been very open on my podcast. I am divesting out of my stocks in the U.S. and investing in European and Asian stocks because in the U.S., our stocks traded a multiple of 26 times earnings. Germany's 22, Europe, Japan 18, the EU 14, and China 14. I think that's going to regulate or normalize, because the reason that the U.S. has enjoyed such an extraordinary multiple and access to cheaper capital is because when you're an American company, there's an assumption of risk aggressiveness, of great universities, the ability to attract the brightest PhD students in the world, rule of law, access to international markets, consistency. And unfortunately, rule of law, consistency, and the ability to attract the best and brightest in the last 103 days has kind of been thrown out of the window. And I think the result will be that the multiple that the world gives our profits of our companies is going to come down. So put another way, if American stocks were to decline to the multiple that Chinese stocks trade at, Meta and Alphabet could double their earnings and their stock would remain flat. And I think we're about to see this massive multiple contraction across the U.S. markets.
Talking about interest or talking about wealth, I think if you sum up all the wealth of the American billionaires, we come up to $5 to $6 trillion. So if we take away all the money from the billionaires, all their assets, all their real estate, everything, we can set down the national debt by $6 trillion. And then we still add $2 trillion per year at the current rate. What do you say to people that say billionaires shouldn't exist?
Oh, you need billionaires. The question is, should they be paying a lower tax rate? One of the draws to America is the opportunity to become a millionaire, a billionaire. Where the U.S. has lost the script is that, so I'm in higher education. I teach at a quote-unquote elite university. I went to an elite university when I was 18. I went to UCLA. When I applied to UCLA, the admissions rate, the percentage of people who applied who were admitted was 74%. This year, it's going to be 9%. I was raised by a single immigrant mother who lived and died a secretary, but America back in the 80s saw its mission was to help unremarkable people and give them a shot at being remarkable. This year, the admissions rate at UCLA will be 9%. Because there's a very dangerous trend in America where we have decided that America is no longer a platform for helping people be unremarkable people, maybe have a shot at being remarkable. It's become a platform for identifying two groups, and this is led by universities. At universities, elite universities in the United States, we led in two cohorts. We led in the children of rich people. If you're a child in a top 1% income-earning household, you're 77 times more likely to get into an elite university than the bottom 99%. And to make ourselves feel better about just letting in rich kids, we let in a bunch of what I call the freakishly remarkable. That is, kids who have built wells, have patents, are amazing football players. So rich kids and the freakishly remarkable. But here's the problem. 99% of our children, I can prove to you, are not in the top 1%. And so America has shifted from a place that used to love the unremarkable into a platform for trying to identify a super class of rich kids and of the freakishly remarkable and turn them into billionaires. And what we have done is we have made it such that if you make the jump to light speed, you get richer much faster. I'm very open about my finances. I think people not talking about money is a zeitgeist implemented by rich people to keep the middle and the lower income classes down. Because rich people talk to each other about money all the time. When I was in my 20s and 30s, I was making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and my tax rate was about 37%. Now that I am making millions and sometimes tens of millions in a year, my tax rate is 17%. So effectively what has happened in America is we have a progressive tax, and then once you become a millionaire, it absolutely plummets. And people can go from being worth $20 billion to $400 billion, Elon Musk. Corporations in the U.S. are paying their lowest taxes since 1929. The 25 wealthiest Americans only pay an average tax rate of 6%, because in Washington, basically, our government has been overrun by special interest groups and lobbyists who are mostly controlled by corporations and the ultra-wealthy. So should we have billionaires? Yes. Should they be paying a higher tax rate? Yes. In terms of the deficit, though, you could tax all billionaires by 100% and it still would make up for the deficit. Again, it's the boring things that move the needle. In the U.S., we pay $13,000 per consumer for health care. You pay about $6,500 per person, and yet we live less long, we're more obese, we're more anxious, and we're more depressed. So we are probably going to need, at some point, some means of nationalizing healthcare and bringing healthcare costs down. You could reduce the defense budget, you could reduce Social Security, you could reduce entitlements until we address, again, it's the boring stuff, our healthcare crisis, where we pay the most for the worst product in the world. We're not going to manage our deficit.
Thank you. Scott, you write.
I love that. The boring stuff never gets applause. Thank you. I appreciate that.
That's next to me. Everything looks much, much smarter. So that also helps. You write books.
Yeah.
And in November, you have a new book coming out called Notes on Being a Man. In Western societies, young men are falling behind in school, in dating, in work. And what are some learnings that you have made during the writing of this book that are evidence-based but regularly blow people's minds?
So this is something I think about a lot, and that is, if you look at why we elected an insurrectionist as president in the United States, there are three groups that pivoted hardest from blue to red. The three groups that got President Trump elected were Latinos, who didn't want to be identified as one group. But numbers two and three, the biggest pivots from blue to red, were people under the age of 40. People under the age of 40 in the United States are 24% less wealthy than they were 40 years ago. People over the age of 70 are 72% wealthier. So young people are not doing well. In addition, the people who are really not doing well across young people are men. Young men are struggling. If you go into a morgue in the United States and there's five people who have died by suicide, four of them are men. And if there was any other group of people killing themselves at four times the rate as the control group, there'd be programs and empathy. But because of the disproportionate unfair advantage that I registered as a white heterosexual male born in the 60s, there's now a lack of empathy for the 19-year-old male. The 19-year-old male in the United States is paying the penalty for the unfair advantage I received. Four times as likely to kill themselves, three times as likely to be addicted, 12 times as likely to be incarcerated. So we don't have a homeless problem or an opioid problem in the U.S. We have a male homeless problem. We have a male opiate problem. But the problem is women have taken so much shit in the United States for so long that if you are in any way seen as advocating for men, you're seen as being anti-women. And that's not the case. Empathy is not a zero-sum game. Gay marriage did not hurt heteronormative marriage. Civil rights did not hurt white people. Women in Western Europe and the United States aren't going to continue to flourish, and they are flourishing. This is a wonderful thing. This is a collective victory. But they're not going to continue to flourish if men continue to flail. And the reality is, it's now 60-40 female to male in college. It's probably 2-1 when you look at graduation rates because males drop out of college. And you think, well, okay, women deserve it. Women are working hard. Good for them. That's fine. I'm not saying we should do anything to get in the way of women's progress. But there's some very hard truths. And that is, when men don't have a romantic relationship, let me back up. When women don't have a romantic relationship, they pour some of that relationship energy into work and into their friend network. When men don't have a romantic relationship, they pour it into video games and porn and conspiracy theory, and they start blaming women for their lack of romantic opportunities and are more prone to misogynistic content. They start blaming immigrants for their economic problems. And because young men are doing so poorly in Europe and in the U.S., we see the rise of nationalists and populists who will tap into their anger tell them it's not their fault and start demonizing women and start demonizing immigrants. This is the most dangerous trend in the West right now. So we need more programs to level up our young men. Young men, only 1 in 3 young men under the age of 30 is in a relationship. 2 in 3 women under the age of 30 is in a relationship. And you say, well, that's mathematically impossible. It's not, because women are dating older because they want more economically and emotionally viable men. If you survey women, 50% of women say they won't date a man shorter than them. I think it's more than that, because it's an embarrassing thing to say, because women instinctively want a man who they feel can physically protect her because she is more vulnerable during gestation, during childbirth. The new form of height and broad shoulders and muscles is money. And because now in the U.S., women are making more money under the age of 30 in cities, and more single women own homes than men, which is a wonderful thing, but the knock-on effect is the following. Women mate socioeconomically horizontally and up. Men mate horizontally and down. And when the pool of men that is horizontal and up, you end up with a pool of viable mates for women that is shrinking. If you go on a dating site in the United States and there are 50 men and 50 women, 46 of the women will show all of their attention to just 4 men, usually based on their ability to signal resources and height. So that leaves 46 men all vying for the attention of just 4 women. Now, why is that happening? Traditionally, throughout the modern economy in the United States and Europe, if you talk to couples who have been married longer than 30 years, 80% of them, 4 in 5 couples, say that one was more interested in the other in the beginning. And it was almost always the man was more interested. We don't have an honest conversation around mating. Let's have an honest conversation around mating. Women have a much finer filter for mating than men. If we all went back here and got drunk, the majority of the men in this audience would agree to have sex with the majority of women in this audience. The majority of the women in this audience would have sex with none of the men. And that is because women have a much finer filter. And the way men have been able to get through that filter is by demonstrating excellence, demonstrating kindness, demonstrating artisanship, demonstrating an ability to succeed. The question now is, where does a young man find a venue to demonstrate excellence? 40% of the bars and pubs in the United Kingdom have closed. We have remote work. We have a lack of religious institutions. If you talk to people who've been married, they will say, I wasn't interested in him in the beginning. Again, finer filter. But at church, I found out he was really kind to his parents. I found out at work he was really good at what he did. We hung out a lot, and I found out that he was funny. So there are fewer venues for men to demonstrate excellence and, quite frankly, for women to fall in love. And the result is, in the United States, 60% of U.S. households that had a 30-year-old used to have a child in that household. Now it's 27%. And you think, well, if people don't have kids and women ascend economically, that's fine. But the problem is that while a woman thrives or can be just as fine without a relationship, it ends up men need relationships more. And I want to be clear, it's not women's obligation to service men. But we do need to level up young people such that there's less proximity to depression, obesity. And what you have is when men haven't had a relationship, they either haven't been married or cohabitated with a woman by the time they're 30 or another man, there's a 1 in 3 chance they become addicted to substances. So essentially, we are evolving a new species of asexual and asocial males. And the nemesis, the enemy of young men is the following. The most talented people in the world, the most well-financed companies in the world, with godlike technology, are trying to convince young men that they can have a reasonable facsimile of life on a screen with an algorithm. Why go out and try and approach people and establish a friendship That's hard. It's social capital. There's a pecking order when you can go on Reddit or Discord. Why go through the bullshit and aggravation of getting a job, putting on a suit, commuting to work, putting up with the injustice at a workplace when you can make money trading stocks or crypto on Robinhood or Coinbase? Why on earth would you figure out a way to look nice, work out, groom yourself, endure rejection, go out, try and demonstrate excellence, try and develop a sense of humor, get a rap, get a plan that signals resources that in the future you might be able to take care of a family? Why do any of that when you have porn? So what you have is a group of men who are sequestering from society. And when they're not social, they literally become unviable mates and they become shitty citizens. They become more prone to misogynistic content and nationalist content. The reality is, while being physically stronger, men under the age of 30, especially boys, are emotionally and mentally weaker than women. And we're seeing that show up. The absence of young people getting together, more young women are dating older men. So the number of young men finding relationships is declining, and it is really hard on them. And it has all sorts of economic and political ramifications. So I just want to move a little bit to solutions. I think we need to find more venues for young people to meet, mate, and fall in love and be more economically viable. Israel has some of the lowest levels of young adult depression in the West, despite having existential threats. And I think one of the keys to their success is mandatory national service. They're outside. They're fit. They're working in the agency of their country. They're learning how to handle heavy weaponry. They're learning that someone from a different sexual orientation, a different ethnicity, a different income group is not that person. They're Israeli. Americans need to interact with each other and start developing a sense of purpose. They're finding mentors, friends, and mates. We need to massively level up economically young people. We have a minimum wage in the U.S. of $7.25. The NASDAQ has gone up sevenfold in the last 30 years. The minimum wage has stayed the same. We have a tax policy that transfers young money from young people to old people. So one, an increase in empathy for how much young people are struggling, realizing programs that help young people won't come at the cost of any other special interest group. More national service, more venues like this where people get together. Let me say something more provocative. I think young people need to drink more. I think this anti-alcohol movement is a bad thing for young people. I think the risks to a 25-year-old liver are dwarfed by the risks of social isolation. My advice to any young person is to get out of the house more, drink more, and make a series of bad decisions that might pay off.
I drink to that.
Okay.
I think as everybody knows, you are a very analytical person. You look at evidence, but I hope there are some people on this planet that you don't know if to make heads or tail of. So I have something for you. It's a secret truth serum that you can put into them. And then for 1 hour, they won't be able to lie.
Okay.
So you can ask them for their motives and you would get back the truth.
Like Wonder Woman's golden lasso.
Sorry?
Wonder Woman had a golden lasso that made people tell the
truth. Something like that. Yeah, we can figure out the form.
Okay.
But what would be the person that you would like to interrogate? That you would like to interview? And what would you ask them? If you had the opportunity of getting the absolute truth out of one person on this planet for 1 hour. Take your time.
The absolute truth. I'm a big fan of Carl Sagan. I think he predicted a lot. I'd want to go back and he always told the truth. I'd want to say, what do you think we should do? I'd like to go back and ask Jesus if, in fact, he was the Son of God, and if so, what do we do? I'd like to speak to Winston Churchill for a few minutes and ask him, what do we do? I'd like to talk to the founding fathers of America and ask them, what do we do? I think that America is in a really rough place right now. So I would want to just advise on how we get out of this mess. So I don't know. That's not a very good answer, but I would seek advice on what we should be doing right now.
I think on this kind of questions, there is no good or bad answers.
No bad answer.
I was, of course, expecting you would say, you go to Trump and ask him, are you serious? Like, what do you really, what is your true motive? But you would rather go to Jesus.
I know Trump's motive. His motive is money.
Okay.
His motive isn't to help America. His motive isn't to help other people. It's to become the richest person in the world. And that's the motive of every CEO of these big tech firms. They pretend to give a shit about people. They don't. We keep hoping that shaming them is going to result in Meta putting on child safety. We need laws. If we're waiting for the better angels of our tech leaders to save the world, don't hold your breath. We need laws. We need the American public and the European public to elect leaders that have the domain expertise, the backbone, and the courage to implement laws. Because at the end of the day, there's so much reward in having money. You get more opportunity for your kids, access to better health care, broader selection set of mates, that you will make incremental decisions that might hurt other people as long as you can make other money. That's the reason why we have laws. In sum, until we put a big tech executive in jail, your daughters are going to continue to self-harm and young men are going to continue to be radicalized. Enough already. We need laws.
Scott, for me, this was peak life. I hope for you it wasn't too horrible. I appreciate the work that you do. I appreciate the new book coming out. I think this topic is vastly underhyped. It will be part of society for the next decade to talk about exactly that.
Can I make one just call out or one request? The moment a young man comes off the tracks, if you were to reverse engineer when a young man starts to fail, it's when they lose a male role model. Boys in single-parent homes have terrible outcomes. Girls in single-parent homes have the same outcomes. Again, it ends up that boys are much more emotionally, they're much weaker. So we have something in the U.S. called Big Brothers and Big Sisters, and there are three times as many women applying to be big sisters as there are men applying to be big brothers. And I don't know what the stats are in Germany, but I imagine that's the same. The ultimate expression of masculinity, you take care of yourself, you take care of your family, you take care of your employees. But the ultimate expression of masculinity is to get involved in the life of a boy that's not yours. In sum, if we want better men, we have to be better men. Get involved in the life of a boy.
Thank you. Time's run out. Thank you from me personally.
Thank
you from the audience. Let's hear it for Professor Scott Galloway.
Thank you.